Hi everybody, this is Stella from The Beauty of Play. This week's content on how to bring contextualization to history is mostly written material, but I know that each of us takes in and processes information differently, so I wanted to have an audio that you could listen to. So the following is me reading the blog post. I knew something was missing in our history studies, but I wasn't sure what it was. Growing up, history had always been my least favorite subject, but now it's one of my favorites. It has to do with how history was taught. I felt like I was memorizing random dates and events without the context. I wanted history to be different for my kids, so I began to look for ways to do that. One experience in particular really stands out in my mind. During my son's early years, we read about the Renaissance and Leonardo da Vinci. At the time, there was a Leonardo da Vinci exhibit in Tampa that we went to see with some friends of ours. And while we were there, a docent passed by giving a tour to a group of adults. This observant and wonderful docent noticed that both of our children were interested in the information that she was giving, so she started engaging with our kids, as well as the rest of the group. What really held their interest, and ours as well, is that she provided context. She painted the narrative for us in her words and in her stories. She told us about Leonardo's life, and what Italy was like at the time when he was living there, who his patrons were. She told us that Leonardo was homeschooled. She told us about his contemporaries, one of which was Michelangelo, as well as their competition with each other. Seeing these replicas of Leonardo's work, some of his original paintings, as well as hearing the stories that the docent was telling us, really made history come to life for us. This is what contextualization can do for history. Living history books. When I started to bring context into our homeschooling, it changed everything about history for both my kids and myself. We started with Charlotte Mason-style living books. Living books are simply engaging, story-style books that bring the subject to life for a child. Within history, a lot of these are fiction, but they can also be nonfiction. What makes a living book applicable for history is that it's true to the time and the events that were happening in history. It brings context by telling someone's story, by giving us a look at what the day-to-day life was, how events affected people of that time. We've read a number of living history books through our years of studying history in our homeschooling. I want to share a couple of books that really stand out in my mind of what a living history book is. Nori Ryan's Song, written by Patricia Riley Giff, is a really good example of fictional living history book. The story revolves around Nori and how she and her family deal with the potato famine in Ireland from 1845 to 1852. The author has obviously done a great deal of research, and we can see this in the backdrop of the surroundings and the daily life that Nori and her family go about within their community. The book talks about people going out to sea to fish, and people gathering seaweed along the shore, and even eggs along the cliffs. In addition, it talks about the daily knitting that they would do and keeping up with the animals. In the story, we see the impact of the relationship between England and Ireland at the time. We see a lot of the disconnect between the peoples where food is being exported at the same time that people of the island are going hungry. We see the suffering of the Irish people from the potato blight and the mass immigration into the United States. We studied this particular book during our Industrial Revolution block. For our Industrial Revolution block, We had quite a bit of focus on the Transcontinental Railroad of the United States. During this time in our history, we had a mass immigration from both the Irish and the Chinese, and a large portion of these immigrants built the Transcontinental Railroad, the Irish from the east to west and the Chinese from the west to the east. Bringing in this book and a couple of shorter books about the Chinese Ping Rebellion and the immigration to the United States gave us a better context for why these people were here and what they contributed. More recently, we have studied Native America and the beginning of U.S. history. There are a couple books that stand out in this time period. One is the fiction book by Native author Lewis Eldridge, The Birch Bark House. She wrote an entire series about a delightful character, Omakius, or Little Frog, and her daily life within her community and her home, and the forced migration caused by Europeans moving westward. It shows Omakius's day-to-day life and her connection to her community. The book talks about how they build their house, how they gather food, as well as how they tan a hide. We are delved straight into the culture with an understanding of what is expected of children versus adults. It gives us a better understanding of what it might be like to be indigenous during that time. Another example of a nonfiction living history book would be Never Caught by Erica Armstrong Dunbar. In this book, we see life through a girl born into enslavement in the home of the Washingtons. It clearly gives us an idea of what life would be like for the enslaved and what a child would experience to grow up in that environment. It gives all the information that you would expect about the discrepancies between the Washingtons and their enslaved people, but surprisingly to me, this book gave wonderful context for the time period. It gave insight into what daily life was like for the Washingtons. It gave insight into the struggle that both Martha and George had during this time period, which was in the American Revolution and the forming of the nation. It also gave wonderful insight into the different American cities at the time. Even though this book was nonfiction, it was engaging and narrative in style, telling the woman's phenomenal story. Mapwork. Mapwork is another aspect that can bring contextualization to our history studies. It's one thing for us to say the Native population was severely impacted by European colonization, and it's another for us to look at a series of maps, or make that series of maps, and see the area dwindle smaller and smaller until there's practically nothing left. When I use map work, I'm usually pretty intentional with the maps that I'm choosing and the work that we're doing for them. This obviously changes depending on what we are studying. For instance, when we were studying Native America, I wanted to use map work for a variety of reasons. One was to show the overall geography of North America so that we could see the impact of that geography on different indigenous peoples and how they dress, the crafts that they made, what they ate, and what their homes were made of. We used a salt dome map for this because salt dome maps do a wonderful job showing geography. With a salt dome map, we have the ability to show elevation, the mountains and the valleys and the rivers. I will leave a salt dome recipe for you at the end of this post. Another map that we used for Native American studies when we hit the Plains region was a decrease of the Buffalo Range. We did this through a wet-on-wet watercoloring process where we started out with a larger range in one color and then added the dwindling ranges with different colors, one on top of the other. The time period before contact with Columbus, the bison population was highly abundant. It maintained several expansive communities of the Plains people. By showing this decrease in the bison population in the area, we can see how profoundly this impacted the native communities. The last map that I want to talk about within our Native American studies was the language groups for Native Americans. The reason that I chose this is because it clearly shows relationships between different peoples, in that if two different peoples share a common language ancestry, then they are more recently connected than another group of peoples that did not share that language. It also helped to demonstrate, which was one of my main goals for this block, that there was a large diversity of peoples across the United States prior to the Columbian Exchange. One last map I want to talk about is the map that we did for World War I. We did this map because World War I is so complex in how each of the countries got involved in the war. From all the research that I've done, without the different alliances that existed in Europe and across the world at the time, it's very likely that there wouldn't have been any war at all. I did something different when we did this map that I didn't do for the others. We started out by doing a map of Eastern Europe that showed all the alliances and those countries that had no particular alliance. We used three different colors for this so that we could see the different alliances. At this point, I made a photocopy of her map so that we could cut out the different countries and place them accordingly to how they fell out in the war. As you can imagine, war is complicated sometimes, and even if the countries had certain alliances with other countries, they didn't always keep those alliances within the war. Understanding World War I can be rather confusing, and the visuals with the map work really helped us to keep up with all the changes in alliances. Timelines. If you're influenced by Charlotte Mason, you have heard about the Book of Centuries. The Book of Centuries is essentially a large timeline that any event or person in any of our studies gets placed within one book. You can purchase a wide variety of Book of Centuries online that other people have made, but it's easy enough to make your own. It really only requires a notebook of blank pages. The thing to remember when making these pages that purchase books already do for you is that as we get closer to the present period, we need more pages for the same length of time. I will show you a Book of Centuries that I purchased and one that we've made, and I will try to be more descriptive about the time increments that we put on each of the pages. The idea with the Book of Centuries is that it covers all of the subjects, so obviously it covers the events and people in history, yet it also covers all the other subjects. This brings similar context that the tour of Leonardo da Vinci's work brought for us, or a living history book, in that we are seeing what events and people are happening during the same time period. For instance, it's interesting to know that while Queen Elizabeth in England was watching Shakespeare's plays, there were colonies happening in the United States, and Robert Hooke was also discovering the first cell in that same century. Sometimes timelines can be used for contextualization by combining a world map with a timeline to show what else is happening at the time. Going back to the Industrial Revolution, where the Continental Railroad was built by the wide variety of U.S. immigrants, we can see what else is going on in the world right before this time period and right after this time period, and see that the Irish and the Chinese immigrations were so imperative, and also why we have so many Black Americans working on the railroads. Projects. The last tool for bringing context into our history that I want to talk about are projects. Projects can bring an understanding to history that we might not have before. For instance, for our early American study, I brought a few handcrafts for the block to give an understanding that we hadn't gone through the Industrial Revolution, and all the things that would have been done by machine after the revolution were having to be done by hand before the revolution. We did things like spinning wool with a hand spindle and weaving on a rigid heddle loom. This gave us an understanding of the skill, time, and effort necessary to make clothing. Some of the projects that we do translate the history better than others. For example, when we did our Native American studies, we did several arts that are traditionally done in indigenous communities of the area. We made pine needle baskets, corn husk dolls, maple candy, and hominy. We had conversations about how these different skills were so important to the different people we were studying. We had conversations about the prayer and intention that goes into making these items. These projects translate the history well. I also want to put a little side note in here. When we are studying different peoples, it's important that we have a discussion with our children about the difference between appreciation versus appropriation of culture. More recently, when we were studying the Constitution, and I wanted something for our hands to do while we were listening to our studies, we made a paper replica of the White House by Dover Books. It was a little bit challenging to do with the cutting and gluing and so forth, but it wasn't particularly deep from a historical standpoint. It gives the basic overall shape from the outside, but no context to the outside or the history of the building. The point that I'm trying to make here is that if you are looking for a project to provide contextualization in your history, it needs to translate the history well. Not all of our projects have to be fabulously detailed and steeped in rich historical context, but it is helpful to be aware and know what your goals are for that project. We've done a number of historical projects over the years. Some of these have included doing Sumi-e when we were studying Japan, and building a model of the Dome of the Rock when we were studying the Golden Age of Islam. We approached our Africa block through fabric, so we made several different kinds of fabric for that block. We made a paper replica of the globe when we were studying Shakespeare, and some replica of Leonardo da Vinci's inventions during the Renaissance as well. During our Explorers block, we made some paper replica of the ships. Conclusion. These are four aspects that I've talked about today for bringing contextualization to history, which is basically bringing more meaning to our history. They are living books, map work, timelines, and projects. I'm going to do a short video so that I can give you a little better description on some of these with examples of what we have done, and so that you will have some visuals to go with that. And that was the post. Thanks for listening. As always, if you have any questions, you can contact me by email, leave a comment after the post, or use the contact form in our membership area. I hope you enjoyed it, and happy homeschooling.